And welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. Giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thank you so much for joining us here on the program as we are in the process of celebrating 10 years of bringing you this radio program, starting in 2007, the first Saturday in September. That's when we were on. Now we're on Sundays at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m., Monday mornings at 1 a.m., and we stream live at richarddugan.com, as well as archive these radio programs at the radio shows page of richarddugan.com. We also would like to hear from you. Send us an email, TMYS, that's for Tell Me Your Story, TMYS at richarddugan.com. Love to hear from you. Give us any of your feedback. And we have begun a new process, if you will, a new sequence, a new scheduling endeavor. And we'll see how that goes. And that is that every broadcast on Sunday morning at 7 a.m. is different from the broadcast on Sunday evening at 7 p.m., I should say, is different from the broadcast Monday morning at 1 a.m., meaning that you will have an opportunity to hear a different program, a different interview. But they're all archived at richarddugan.com and the radio show's page. It's because I've been doing so many interviews. I'm having such a great time with this. I want to expand the opportunities both for my guests as well as for you to find out more about what's going on in the world and find out more about how you can live a life that is a thriving life. That's what we want. And part of that has to do with educating ourselves about one another. Yes, it's important to learn about oneself and where each of us comes from. But it's also important to begin the process of understanding more about where others are coming from, not just in terms of their philosophy, their politics, their lifestyle, etc., but their heritage. What are some of the historical and ancestral aspects to their lives that they've brought into their lives today? I heard an interesting comment on television once, not too long ago, actually. It was a complaint that, and this was from a particular group, that said that they were losing their culture here in the United States. And the interesting thing was they were not of any specific ethnicity that you could readily define. They were just of a skin tone, white. And there was the complaint they were losing their culture. And I thought, what culture? What culture are you losing? And it's a legitimate question. And yet there are many people in this country of color, if we want to use that phrase, who are also losing their culture because they're asked to, or as this country became a country and began to develop, forced people to assimilate and give up. Native Americans are a prime example. We're going to talk a little bit about this. We're also going to talk a little bit about a country whose landmass is enormous. I'm not sure it's as large as Russia, but it certainly is very large in terms of its population. We're going to learn more about China today from a good friend of mine who I met some time ago, and she is a local artist, and it is CJ Liu, and you are of Chinese descent.
Yes.
And we're going to learn a little bit from your perspective about what your understanding of Chinese history is. Mm-hmm. I've mentioned many times when it comes to when we talk about alternative health and wellness, mm-hmm. That I would trust Chinese medicine over any other medicine because it's 5,000 years old and they never had an FDA. They mm-hmm. just knew it worked. Mm-hmm. They just knew it worked over centuries. They just knew, oh, this is what you do for a head cold. This is what you do for et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So I would trust it more because there's been no real interference. Mm-hmm. I would assume that particular aspect of Chinese history has been maintained predominantly in the smaller villages and hamlets throughout China, not so much in the big industrial cities. Mm-hmm. They're getting more into modern, what we would call traditional medicine, Western medicine, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But you are also, I've already forgotten the name of the type of art, and it's basically characters that you draw, Chinese characters.
So I do ink paintings.
Okay.
And when you delve into the history of ink, you cannot escape calligraphy. Mm-hmm. So calligraphy is the backbone of my art.
So it is calligraphy.
Yes,
okay.
It is.
I know that when you are writing and this is the language, when you are writing in Chinese, every line in that character has a meaning.
It's you can think about it as a Lego blocks. Every character has at least three or four Lego blocks, and each block has a basic character. So the roots character, you could say. Mm-hmm. So, for example, you can take my name, the character C. It means thinking, and it consists of two character blocks. Of one is feel, like farming feel, and the other one is heart. So a feel of heart means thinking, and then you could go on and say, you know, Chinese philosophy believes that we think with our heart, you know, not our head or the mind.
Right.
We usually say follow your heart. There's also a saying like this. So I think maybe it's the same line of thoughts.
Right. And obviously the rest of your name as well. And what it makes me think of course, is the Hebrew alphabet, as they call it. The alphabet has 22 characters. And it's made up of different lines as well. And I don't know if it goes quite that deep, but I do know that each letter has a legend of its own, has its own color designation, has its own number designation, own vibration. It has a story. Then you start putting those letters together with words, and it changes.
Yes.
And then you put the words together with other words, and it changes again.
Yes.
Words, the sentences into paragraphs, into chapters, into books, etc. However, when you translate it into another language, it's like all of that goes away. Unless the person doing the translating translates and is able to try to carry over into that other language, like English, those elements. But that's, I would assume that would be very difficult to do. And I think Chinese is the same way, is that you bring these different characters together, as you use the term,
the
philosophy of Lego blocks, which I played with as a kid too, so I have a good understanding.
Yeah.
And it was very cool building things with those. So it must be very interesting when you start putting things together. Obviously, you're trying to communicate a thought, in the characters that you're putting together.
Yeah. You can break it down further by saying, in every complicated characters, there's radicals. And radicals can be made out of, you could say, material or elements or even verb, like radicals that signify it's a verb. So, for example, all the action verb, like playing, beating, or taking things, or putting down things, has a hand radical. Usually it's on the left side of the character. So you can sort of decipher, even though if you encounter a character that you do not know, you could still decipher it's an action character. And if you look at the right side of the character, usually it's the fun, like the sounding, you know, you sound. When you read it, you know that the sound is along those lines. And so, you know, the whole dictionary of, you know, Chinese characters is almost 5,000. You cannot blindly memorize everything. So, you know, in every characters, they actually give you cues in terms of how to decipher the character. And so I'm just using, you know, for example, again, my name, C, is a feel and a heart, and heart would be the radical of the whole character because it has more meaning in the word.
Did you have to learn Chinese? You didn't grow up necessarily speaking it and writing it?
Actually, it's my mother tongue. I grew up in Malaysia. And it has used to be half the peninsula is Chinese populated, and slowly in the 50s and 60s, political change and, you know, Malaysia as a country decided to have not less Chinese per se, but Singapore was once Malaysia, and I think a lot of people didn't know that, and it's almost 90% Chinese ethnic. Of how do you call it? Chinese is not like nationality in this case; it's ethnicity. So there's majority Chinese is in Singapore, and when Malaysia gained independence 1957. It's almost 60 years now. On the 31st of August, we are called Malaya, and then Singapore was it's all together. It's a group.
Right.
It's a group including Indonesia. They were like in the makings of becoming one country, but in the end, the negotiation didn't go through.
It kind of broke down, yeah.
And so somehow we become minorities, which is funny. And now we are like the second largest ethnicity in Malaysia. And so I grew up knowing Chinese, going to school. My primary school is all in Chinese. And as I progress in the educational system, Malay, which is the main language or the national language, become more and more important in national examinations. So some Chinese students decided that it's too much for them to master two languages. So it's actually becoming optional as you grow older to sort of give up the language.
Wow.
The educational system allows you to do that.
Interesting. So I want to try to understand a little bit more about this aspect of ethnicity. Now, you say that if I was to refer to you as Chinese, I'm referring more to what?
My ethnicity.
That is your ethnicity.
Yes.
Even though you were born and raised or you were in Malaysia, that's part of or was part of China at one time?
I think you can call it, you know, there are countries that give gifts to China for protection.
Right.
So I think a large region of Southeast Asia, including ancient Japan and Korea, they used to go to see the emperor once in a while with gifts and, you know, silks and silver. And, you know, it's just like alliances. So it's like alliance under the protection of the Chinese Empire.
Okay. I see. So you were under that umbrella.
Yes.
But not necessarily. Even though, again, you say you are Chinese and your ancestry and so forth. And so what are your parents, are they specifically from Malaysia or they are from other parts of mainland China?
So when I talk about this, I was talking about like the geographical history of Malaysia. That's their relationship with China.
Okay.
And if it's about my personal history, many Chinese migrate to Southeast Asia. The big waves that is in the 1900s is before the war. So it's in the 30s. And maybe also during the Cultural Revolution, right before the 70s and 60s. And so my grandparents and great-grandparents came for work, looking for jobs in Malaysia in the 30s. And for example, my mother would tell me stories that my great-grandfather from her side would come for the job first. And once he settled, he would send a letter home. And what happened is my great-grandmother sort of signed up that they would have a walking tour. And they would walk all the way from Southern China, that's where my ancestral home is. This was in the 40s, I think, 30s, 40s. And they would walk from Vietnam all the way to Malaysia, which took them a month. And my grandmother was the firstborn, and she was 4 years old. And back then, to determine a kid whether she's good or not, or he is good or not, is when they need the mom to carry them on the back. So a spoiled kid would be the kid who needs to be carried on the back during this 1 month trip. And a good kid would be the one, even at 4 or 5, or a toddler, walk on its own. And so there are still stories like this that is still a living memory. And, you know, my grandma's still alive and she's 84. And so this was when she was 4 years old.
Yeah, my mother is 83. So, you know, I'm sitting here. And your grandmother, did you say?
Yes.
Your maternal
grandmother.
So your grandmother had your mother fairly early, who had you fairly early, because, I mean, if my own mother is in the same range, I'm thinking, wow. Let me ask you about how important, I mean, first of all, we as individuals, you and I, we cannot escape our ethnicity. All right. And yours is, very much out there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I could not say, oh, I know where she's from.
Mm-hmm.
I would make the serious faux pas
mm-hmm.
of saying she's from Asia.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to keep it as broad as possible so as not to make it, oh, as opposed to saying, oh, she must be Vietnamese or Korean or
mm-hmm.
Thai or and going down the list.
Mm-hmm.
I just submitted for a DNA test
mm-hmm.
to find out what my, even though what I've been, I'm hoping what I was told as I was growing up was accurate.
Mm-hmm.
But there was no one, as far as I know, there was no one dominant ethnic
mm-hmm.
A focal point.
Yeah.
You know, certainly on my mother's side, there was a lot of Hispanic,
mm-hmm.
and on my father's side, Irish. Those were the two main ones. And
mm-hmm.
I've heard of the others and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, as the populations have begun to spread out across the globe, the ethnicity gets, how can I put it, sort of diluted.
Mm-hmm.
Because instead of being a purebred, if you will,
yeah.
whatever the nationality is, now
yeah.
it's a conglomeration of 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 or 10 or 20 different
mm-hmm.
Ethnicities.
Mm-hmm.
How important is your Chinese heritage to you as opposed to other parts of your heritage, which I'm sure you've probably looked into?
It's very important. I would say that my heritage is not just ethnicity heritage. It's also the history of the world, actually. You
mm-hmm.
know, what happened in China pre-war was the fall of the Chinese Empire. And the falling of Chinese Empire meaning that China undergo a lot of redefinition.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a country. It was an empire. And then it was undergoing change to fit in with the rest of the world and say, okay, this is a country. And so for me, in order to sort my own personal history out, I couldn't ignore the world history that has happened. And like you said, it's political to say something is purebred. I think it's very political. Like my major is art history, mm-hmm. art, and I like to study art history.
Mm-hmm.
And I would go to, for example, Museum of Fine Art in Boston, and I would saw a special exhibition that celebrates how the Japanese culture and European culture was intermixed since the 1800s. It
mm-hmm.
was the first Asian culture that really, really became a mainstream in Europe. And, you know, to the likes of Picasso and all the big artists, they all love to look at the woodblock print
mm-hmm.
Of Japan. But if you push it further, a lot of the cultural identity of Japan has the artistic ancestry. You know, they got their inspirations from China.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when their monks
right.
studied and traveled to China almost 1,000 years ago. So where does it stop? You know, and then obviously the curatorship of museum usually show pure Japanese art or pure European art. They didn't really celebrate the hybrid,
right,
you know?
Right.
And so when I saw the exhibition that is celebrating a hybrid and I look at the artwork, it reminds of my artwork because I was educated here, my undergrad, and I studied European art first before I went back to study Chinese art.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, I'm already exposed by two cultures. So even you can argue that, yes, I'm, you know, Chinese by heritage.
Mm-hmm.
But my adult life, most of my adult life is spent abroad. And I have since using English as a way of communicate my mind mm-hmm. or speak my mind. And it's very different, like you said, you know,
yeah.
some of the nuances of the Chinese language could be lost in translation.
Yeah.
And so after graduation and I got a fellowship to study ink painting, it was like rediscover the other side of my brain, mm-hmm. the brain that uses Chinese. I mean, I still speak with my family in Mandarin and everything. Mm-hmm. But when you look at the text, an ancient text, and analyze it based on the books you read that is now in the Chinese language, suddenly I discover a whole different perspective than when I was studying books in English.
Do you think you'd still have that perspective if those books had been translated into English as opposed to reading them in Chinese?
So now is a good challenge for me because learning rhetorics in English, basically. I learned how to write a thesis. I wrote papers in English, you mm-hmm. know. I know how English writing works. You know, it starts with a thesis sentence and then you elaborate and then full stop. So every paper, you look at the abstract, you kind of know what the paper is about. Mm-hmm. But for Chinese literature or Chinese paper, I guess, it's a lot of guessing games because there's a way of circling around the subject and not the main point, and that's how we talk as well as Chinese. Mm-hmm. And so lots of metaphor, lots of saying it's not this, it's not that, it's not this. And then if you encounter, you know, an article that say it's not this, it's not that, five things that is not, mm-hmm. and then it doesn't tell you what it is, you know, then you have to guess. Yeah. And so for me, it's almost like you have to switch how you think.
Yeah.
In order to understand the point of the article, I guess.
What, from your perspective, because that's all we can get right now, what is the most important aspect of Chinese history, if you will, or maybe let me look at that differently, of Chinese culture, the most important aspect to you? Mm-hmm. That you want to get across to people, that you want to make sure that if you do nothing else in your lifetime, you have at least put it out there. Whether they get it or not, it's a whole other thing. But what you want to put out there.
I read a historian who said that the Europeans, the artifacts of their history is the architecture. And so you have the Roman Colosseum or, you know, the Big Ben Tower. It's the... how do you call it, the machoism or the iconic identity of the European culture is the architecture. And for Chinese, he argues it's in a person, it's in the people. Mm-hmm. Chinese people have underwent mm-hmm. It's just a lot of turmoils. War, turmoils, change, dynastic change. And you said it's a 5,000 year of history, but it's also a 5,000 year history of change. Mm-hmm. And so, for example, there's a, you know, the old, one of the ancient books is called Book of Change. And so for me, to understand Chinese culture, you should start with a person, the person itself. Like you, now you're interviewing me and I am a Chinese person who's born from a Chinese family in Malaysia, and if you chase further back, is of Southern Chinese ancestry. And if you go further back to the Southern China, it is the, how do you call it? It is the food supply of the whole China, mm-hmm. you know? So we are the providers, we are the peasants, we are the folkloric people, you know, we are the memory of food and rituals. A lot of the Taoism rituals are, the memories of Taoism culture is kept in the South. We're not necessarily, you know, the guardians of paintings or
right.
or craftsmanship. And so you need to know where to look if you want to study a certain thing. Mm-hmm. And that's what I found so far in my journey. Because I remember when I, you know, rediscover ink painting, I had to almost do an annual, I would call it annual art pilgrimage in China. And the first year I went to Beijing and I went to the Palace Museum. And it was all the artifacts of the emperor, right? And the royal and the royal family archives. And I realized that it wasn't talking about my own story. It was talking about the power, you know, the people in at, you know, and it's not about my people. My people are not the ones who at power. My people are the ones who are farmers. They migrate because of poverty, because of job, because of, you know, scarce resources. And so you have to look, you have to know where to look for specific accounts of history, I guess. And so in each person, that's a story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, when I use the number 5,000, China's got to be older than that. It's not just 5,000 years old.
It's 3,000 years of written history.
Okay.
5,000 years is probably a lot of mythology that you can chase back to 5,000. But yes, way longer than that.
And nothing is ever created or comes out of a vacuum. Mm-hmm. Okay. And yes, we could sit here for days trying to trace back each step and figure out, okay, well, they came from this and they came from that. And it's like, okay, well, where did the Chinese people originate from? Mm-hmm. And of course, everybody seems to be of, not everybody, but many people seem to think that there is a quote unquote cradle of mm-hmm. civilization, mm-hmm. which is supposedly in the Middle East somewhere, or mm-hmm. maybe it's in Africa. I don't know exactly where.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe it's in Cleveland, for all I know.
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I find it interesting that as time passes and history passes, if you will, and you mentioned, of course, some of Chinese history in a general way. And the first thing that came to my mind as far as going through wars, I thought of the Great Wall.
Mm-hmm.
And the only other wall that I'm familiar with other than the Great Wall is, of course, the wall that is no longer that divided East and West Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a much newer wall,
mm-hmm.
you know. It even got new paint. I don't know that the Great Wall of China has the same accessibility. I'm not aware that there are any large cities that have been built near it.
Mm-hmm.
And what little I know of the history of the wall, it was actually built to, if I'm correct, keep the Huns out or keep them from crossing over. And yet they still found a way, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the purpose of this wall, was to sort of divide or to protect a certain area. But this mm-hmm. wall is several thousand miles long.
Yes.
And took hundreds of years.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even know. Is it completed? Has it been completed? Or was it at one point?
Well, it's very interesting you talk about the history of the wall, because the borders change almost every
yeah.
dynasty. And so what people... What is remain of the wall? Sometimes people call, although this is the Ming Wall, so it means is the Ming Dynasty wall border.
Okay.
And this is the Qin Emperor
mm-hmm.
is the first one who started the whole wall construction. But there isn't a remain of that,
right,
of the Qin Wall, because it's too long ago.
Okay.
But you could still go to the Han, which is the next dynasty. There are still some remains of the Han Wall, which is outside of the Dunhuang. I went there last year, actually. It's at by the Gobi Desert. And it's interesting because the wall actually also borders with the Uyghur territories, which is right now it's also a very, how do you call it? Contentious area, I mm-hmm. guess. There's a lot of political upheaval
yeah.
because it's Muslim ethnicity.
Okay.
They speak Mandarin, and they would go to mosque and recite the Quran in Mandarin.
Wow.
Exactly. So it's a very, very interesting history we have there. But yeah, right now the Han Wall borders is inside of China.
Mm-hmm.
And it used to be, I think, if I'm not wrong, is to block out the Mongolians.
The Mongolians?
Yes. And right now, Inner Mongolia is part of China.
Okay.
Outer Mongolian is not. And so, yeah, the border changed so much. And so who are our enemies change as well? across the dynasty.
And that's another interesting aspect, too. You speak of the different rulers and their period of time as dynasties.
Yes.
Whereas, let's say, in England in particular or in Europe, they had it was royalty and they had kings and queens and and so forth, that type of setup.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the same thing, just by a different name.
Yes.
It's still royalty. You're still talking about an emperor or an emperor. I don't know if there were ever any empresses, because usually it was men who were controlled in the show.
There are. But usually they're depicted very cruelly in history because it's such a patriarchal history.
Mm-hmm.
And so the historian like to write about the empress who become emperor at one point at their reign. They would call them the ones who stole the power from their husbands or their sons.
Ah.
But they are female rulers. They were.
and I'm curious also as to the various philosophies. Has there been or is there even today one dominant philosophy that encompasses most of China, or is there a name you could give to it, and that there are, just like with most philosophies, there are derivations, sects, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, of Christianity, you have Catholic and Protestant, and then those are even broken down into smaller groups as well.
Yeah.
But is there one dominant philosophy that has existed in China?
In contemporary China, I would argue, is a mix of Confucianism, Buddhism, and Taoism.
And when you say Confucianism, you're talking about Confucius.
Yes.
Okay.
The teachings of Confucius.
Correct. Okay.
I would say in modern China. But if you look at the history, Buddhism only came in Tang Dynasty, which is 1,000 years ago.
Okay.
A little bit more than 1,000 years ago. And one of the most ancient texts. For example, the founder of Taoism is Lao Tzu. And Lao Tzu and Confucius, actually, they met at one point.
Oh.
That's what historian would argue.
Mm-hmm.
And they talk of each other's teachings and they respected each other. But one is more about Confucius, as everybody knows, it's more about virtues and how to be moral, and mm-hmm. and it's the backbone of the patriarchal hierarchical system mm-hmm. of a country, of a family, and Lao Tzu, which is more free, I guess, it's more about yin and yang, and you talk about Chinese medicine, a mm-hmm. lot of the philosophy they took it from Lao Tzu. So I would say both philosophers are equally important, mm-hmm. and alongside Buddhism. And Buddhism, when you talk about sects, is also very loosely coined, because it's so dominant in our lives that I didn't really stop and think, you know, this teaching is Buddhist or that teaching is Confucius. But yeah, there's Tibetan Buddhism that is clearly a different culture.
Mm-hmm.
There's the Buddhism that that is, you know, passed from Sri Lanka all the way to Thailand, and that is slightly different than the ones Chinese believe. But then they all teach internationally right now. So you can't really say Chinese is this Buddhism or that. Because, for example, Zen Buddhism is predominantly in Japan, but they also make their way to US right now. And so it's like, yeah, you just need to know their travel route.
And I'm curious, with Tibetan Buddhism, you have the figurehead of the Dalai Lama.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And I know in Buddhism specifically, or in general, and by the way, I am familiar with Lao Tzu. I'm in the process of reading The Art of War. I know a lot of people are very familiar. As a matter of fact, mm-hmm. they will base their business life around using mm-hmm. the Art of War.
Mm-hmm.
I think my favorite part of the Art of War that I've read is that It's not exactly the first rule, but it's sort of one of the principles, and that is that in terms of learning the art of war is learning not to go to war.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
And one of my favorite, obviously my favorite stories of Buddha, who I believe it was, Siddhartha.
Mm-hmm.
Was his given birth name.
Mm-hmm.
And what I found so fascinating in terms of the story of how he became the Buddha was when he finally came to the Bodhi tree and he sat down and finally it dawned on him that in order for me to find what I'm looking for, I have to stop looking for it, which I thought was so fascinating. It's like, and it's funny because when I think back on my own life, and for example, and I don't know if you've experienced this or not, when I was looking for a girlfriend,
mm-hmm.
and I was in that desperation mode, and there were people who could see that, and they would just stay as far away as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And the moment that I stopped doing that,
mm-hmm.
the floodgates opened,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it was a wonderful thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's true of any aspect of our lives when we're just hell-bent on trying to achieve something.
Mm-hmm.
The moment we stop trying to achieve it is when we probably will. And it's almost, can I use the metaphor of the Chinese puzzle, finger puzzle? That the more you pull to try to get out of it,
mm-hmm.
the tighter it gets.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the moment you relax into it is the moment that you are released.
So I think there's also a story that Buddha was describing balance. And what is balance, right? And believe it or not, modern day's metaphor is the guitar string.
Oh,
you know.
Okay.
And if it's too tight, it, you know, when you pluck it, it might break. If it's too loose, it doesn't make any sound. And so, how do you make the best balance? Is when you, it's not too tight or it's not too loose, and you get the right balance. And you also talk about the desperation, and it would be, you know, the concept of desire. If you eliminate the desire, then you are more peaceful.
Mm-hmm.
But it clashes with the Western concept of being ambitious.
I want patience and I want it now.
ambitious, you want to have goals, you want to succeed, and that's why it's a constant fight.
Yeah.
It's a constant fight.
It really is. Mm-hmm. We're going to continue talking. I find this fascinating, and we're never going to cover all
everything
of the things that we'd like to. And actually, what I'd like to do is continue in the conversation in regards to some of the figureheads. Obviously, we talked, I mentioned in Tibetan Buddhism, you have the Dalai Lama. He is the antithesis, if you will, of Tibetan Buddhism. But in general Buddhism, you have Buddha.
Mm-hmm.
Or Siddhartha,
mm-hmm.
and that story.
Mm-hmm.
But let's talk about some of the other branches of that tree, or even of the other trees that you've mentioned, the other two philosophies in China,
mm-hmm.
that are still part of the philosophy. And I'm also curious as to the use of that philosophy by the dynasties, by the rulers, or if they even used it. And we'll talk about that more. We're talking with C.J. Liu, and a fascinating conversation about the history of China as well as some of the philosophical aspects of it. And I'm Richard Dugan. You're listening to Tell Me Your Story. Stay tuned.
Tell me your story.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, and we are talking with C.J. Liu. She is a local artist here in Santa Barbara. She is a Chinese calligrapher, calligraphy artist, if you will. And I think I did make a mistake. It is Sun Tzu, not Lao Tzu.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
His brother? No, I don't know. His cousin, far removed. What I would like to ask you about now has to do with and a continuation of our conversation here. And I have to tell you, I can't believe how much time has already passed since we began. It's just amazing to me. I'm curious about the influence of the various philosophies on the dynasties down through history, or was there even that? Was it just pure, I want power and control, and I will do whatever it takes, and I'm going to build an army to secure that power and control, as has been done in other parts of the world by other rulers and so forth? I mean, because it seems to me like if they were going to use those philosophies, they're in, because a lot of people now are beginning to study, mm-hmm. for example, the Quran, mm-hmm. to understand where the Muslim faith actually comes from. What are the underpinnings? What's the foundation? Mm-hmm. Or is it really mm-hmm. a religion of peace, a philosophy of peace? Or is it what these other people are telling us that it is, that all of the infidels must be taken care of summarily? Mm-hmm. It's just a crazy, crazy mixed up world mm-hmm. in that regard. But what about that? Did any of these philosophies become a part of were any of these dynasties, these rulers, the emperors, any of them benevolent, kind individuals, or were they all heartless, individuals?
Well, it depends on how far along they are in their reign, I guess, because I think most of the dynasties did not rule more than 300 years, I guess, plus or minus. Mm. So if you are the emperor in the middle, you are really enjoying the fruit of labor of your great-grandparents.
Yeah.
And then you might be a little bit more relaxed, and then you are building up some chaos for your great-grandchildren
Yeah.
And I guess now we are looking at history retrospectively. Religion is just one of the different ways to legitimize power for the emperors, mm-hmm. right? And I study the art where rituals meets art.
Okay.
And so I'm so interested in the spiritual aspect of painting. And as I looked at the different artifacts in China, the more I dug in, the more I found that, for example, I'm interested in shamanism and how you call for the spirit of ancestors or the spirit of different totems like the dragon or the buffalo or the elephants. And I saw all these creatures or animals in the ancient ritual bowls.
Mm-hmm.
And they are of the Zhou dynasty, so it's very beginning of the dynasties. And it was when one of the emperor proclaimed that I am the legitimate king or emperor of this land, and I have the support of the gods. Mm-hmm. And so when you have the support, how do you prove that you have the support of the god? Subsequent dynasty would just say the emperor is the son of God. I guess they wouldn't say God. They would say Tian, which means sky.
Mm-hmm.
So it has a broader sense but there's a huge change, switch from shamanism, and then they no longer rely on the shamans. They just rely on the icons, like the dragon. So the emperor literally adopted the dragon as its own symbol and the color yellow, and then they also disallowed regular people to mm-hmm. use that icon or mm-hmm. use that color, and they also disallow people to use some of the creature symbols that you see in the ritual bowls. And so I guess it's a powerful thing, so it's mine,
mm-hmm.
and therefore I have the closest connection with the totem, the dragon, and therefore I'm the legitimate ruler. And mm-hmm. for many, 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 many dynasties, some adopted Buddhism and say, this is the truth. I found the truth.
Mm-hmm.
We translated the Buddhist text, and now I am the guardian of this truth. And you mentioned the female ruler.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is called Wu Zetian. And she basically commissioned some of the biggest Buddha statue that is now still in China. One is called in the Longmenku, which is in the Shanxi region of China, where I just found out recently that it was the Buddha face is actually her face. So her face was being carved into the statue of Buddha. And that's also a way of legitimizing your power. You don't really tell people, but the people who know knows
it's
your face.
Right.
It's because Buddha's face changed. You know, Buddha, Gautama Siddhartha, you know, he was Indian. And but then if you look at Buddha's statue in China, they are round face, single eyelid, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so they change. And the truth change along with what the empire at the time need. And for me, it's really a relief in this, you know, as a contemporary person, because as I grew older and I needed to communicate my identity to other people, there seemed to be a need to be very strongly identified with one label. Maybe it's a race, maybe it's a nationality, or maybe it's a religion. But as I study the history, it's quite fluid.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually up to a person to adopt what kind of belief system or philosophies they wanted to do in order to gain popularity or traction or legitimacy. And so I always ask this question, and I think it's a very interesting question. I said, is Confucius feminist? Because he created a rule such that the woman has to be the subordinate of the man, right?
Mm-hmm.
Has to be in the house, has to take care of the household, and has to behave or a certain kind of virtues or morality. And obviously, Chinese people interpreted Confucius. You can't say we just adopted whatever he said. We interpreted it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so the interpretations led to foot binding, for example. You know, the woman. Yeah.
You bind the feet.
Yes. And so some would say, it's a Confucius philosophy of taking care of your household. You take care of the household, you take care of the country. Yes and no. You know, what leads to that?
Yeah.
So you can't really say it's Taoism or Confucianism. It's people themselves. They decided that was what was needed. You know, only men attended examinations to you could say, historian actually said that the Chinese examination system is one of the system that even the British adopted in the past, because you would go to a national exam, and if you passed it with flying colors, you automatically become a minister of some sort, and you get appointed. And it's sort of like it's almost like an American dream, because mm-hmm. if you work hard, you pass the exam,
yeah,
you will be. How do you call it? Your class system, right?
Right.
Upward mobility.
Right, exactly.
So, but then only men are allowed to do that. So what is the, you know,
yeah.
There's always a fallback.
Well, there's, yeah, and it's interesting too, our own history here in the United States, our U.S. history, when we start looking at the original documents that are not even 250 years old yet. It talks about all men are created equal.
Mm-hmm.
And if you were to consider the time in which that was written, it referred to all white men are equal.
Mm-hmm.
Not mm-hmm. all men and not all human
mm-hmm.
people are equal, including women.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, it was an exclusive club.
Mm-hmm.
And in some instances, some people would even say that our government leaders who are elected, it's still an exclusive club.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But you're seeing more integration of both male and female, as well as other nationalities
mm-hmm.
who are winning and holding these offices and hopefully having an opportunity to have a say in what's going on in the world. And I think you're right, too, about this aspect of take care of the family, you take care of the country. Mm-hmm. You take care of the whole nation as a whole. And what I find interesting is that philosophy can only last so long. Mm-hmm. The moment there is a natural disaster, for example, mm-hmm. that is the great equalizer. You could be a peasant or a king. Mm-hmm. And if a hurricane comes through, a flood, wildfire, an earthquake levels everything, now everybody's the same, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. you know. And you start seeing, you're either going to see a coming together of the people to help one another, as we see many times in this country, and we see it around the world too. There is no one country that has exclusivity to compassion to one's citizens, mm-hmm. you know, because when there are natural disasters around the world, other countries, they start sending what they can to help out because, mm-hmm. hey, they've either been there before or they know one day we may be there and we're going to need help from them. And so it's the compassionate thing to do to help them to get back on their feet, to rebuild and so forth. And I mean, it was 12 years ago that we had a natural disaster in Louisiana with Hurricane Katrina. Mm-hmm. At that time, the biggest, the worst natural disaster and catastrophe that this country had ever seen. Mm-hmm. Now, and it's really weird, Harvey, a strange name to be using. It's so benign. Mm-hmm. Is now the worst. I mean, and then of course now they're trying to evaluate. It wasn't so much the strength of the storm; it's all the water. And they're talking in the trillions of gallons of water, mm-hmm. 40 and 50 inches. Mm-hmm. I can't even imagine. And then of course they did. One guy did this. He said, "All right, think of it this way: take 3 pennies, mm-hmm. stack them together. Now that's not much." And consider that level of water is now covering from coast to coast, border to border, the entire 48 contiguous U.S. Mm. in that thickness of water over the entire landmass. Mm-hmm. Okay? Mm-hmm. That was as of I think, 3 days into that storm. Mm-hmm. And it's like, what, you know, and people were just coming together. Strangers helping because people were in need. It didn't matter, you know, what had gone on before. They didn't check your religious status. They didn't check your political status, your economic status. Mm-hmm. They didn't check your nationality. They didn't check your gender assignment or your lifestyle.
Yep.
You were in trouble.
Yep.
And they helped.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish that it was possible. I keep thinking that it is. That we could maintain that beyond the disaster and beyond the circumference of that disaster to the rest of the country, mm-hmm. and saying, you know, all this other stuff doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
The communities, the villages, and I don't know if there are other names for the small towns, and they use the word hamlet or what have you, throughout the width and breadth of China. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's an enormous country.
Yes.
Right now, over a billion.
Was it 13 billion or more?
well, we're at seven. We're at almost 8 billion people on the planet.
So it's 1.3.
1.3.
1.4.
1.4. Almost a billion and a half.
Yes.
People in China.
Yeah.
What about the communities? Now, obviously, individuals are going to have their own philosophies,
mm-hmm.
and they may incorporate that into the community or a particular area of a community,
mm-hmm.
and so forth, and then the town or then the city and so forth. And they might trade, mm-hmm. one village to another and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it is those individuals, those communities that make up a country. And I find it fascinating how it seems that the ruling class, if you will, whether they be elected or otherwise, they're still a ruling class.
Mm-hmm.
They seem to forget that.
Mm-hmm.
That if it weren't for you and me, the artist and the broadcaster and all of the other, we'll call them little people, but they're not little.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Without us, nothing would get done. Nothing would happen.
Well, you know, you mentioned villages, community, mm-hmm. and I think during the war, I guess, a lot of the villagers who came out from one village and they would go to Malaysia, and then they would set up a membership, and I would call it the dialect group's membership,
mm-hmm.
clubhouse, you can
okay.
say. So a dialect group comes in from China and they settle in and they would register at the dialect group clubhouse. So instead of the embassy, right, they registered at the dialect group. And so subsequent people who came from the same village, right, once they register, they would be matched with employers of the same village, even in Malaysia. So you can imagine how many hundreds of villages in China, right? And they come to Malaysia to look for jobs. The first thing they would go is to go to a dialect group clubhouse.
Mm-hmm.
And it used to be very important that actually village help each other. Like villages, people from the same village or the same dialect group help each other.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as we progress, there's embassy, there's a country, right?
Mm-hmm.
Chinese ethnicity becomes one. Who knows that Chinese ethnicity has more than 40 dialect groups, you know?
Wow.
So my mom and dad are from two different dialect groups, and they used to not intermarriage, you know?
Right.
And my grandma, my maternal grandma, used to have some concern when my mom and dad met each other. And so we progressed. We made progress by saying, now we no longer need dialect group clubhouse. And maybe 40, 50 years later, you know, present day, now that China is opened and willing to trade and, you know, money is flowing in and out of the country now, the same dialect group who came out and built temples, right,
mm-hmm.
in Singapore or Malaysia, they pour the money back to the same village where the same branch of temple, right, are no longer doing well, you know, and short of money, or some of the rituals are lost, you know, during Cultural Revolution or war. And so there's a pouring back in of culture
mm-hmm.
from diasporan Chinese back to the same village where their great grandparents are from. And so, yeah, there's an affinity or an alliance. However you want to choose, it can be a religious group, or it could be a dialect group,
mm-hmm.
or people of the same surname. Because mm-hmm. used to be people of the same surname lived together, because your surname was assigned, you know, by
okay.
the king,
right.
to perform a certain function. Some of them are generals, you know. Some of them are intellects, and so yeah. There's so many ways to be bond together,
yeah.
to be bind together. Yeah.
I wonder about the again not knowing Chinese history. This to me is the great. How do I put this shortcoming of American education is the fact that we do not spend enough time learning about the history. We do not find a way to make it interesting to the student enough that they want to know more about these other parts of the world and where the kid next to you who is from China or from the Philippines or from Germany or from the Arctic,
mm-hmm.
okay,
mm-hmm.
You know, because there are people living up there too, Eskimos and so forth, where they are coming from,
mm-hmm.
okay, because we all come into the world and into the community with what we've been taught,
mm-hmm.
you know. Were there ever successful rebellions? Now, when you talk about the dynasties,
mm-hmm.
these emperors,
mm-hmm.
they ruled the entirety of Or were there several emperors, several dynasties going on at the same time where they were grappling for power, similar to what went on, for example, I don't know if you're familiar at all with it's the television series Game of Thrones,
mm-hmm.
which is actually an apt title.
I was thinking about that when you talk about
exactly.
disaster.
Where you've got seven thrones
winter
up for grabs.
Winter is coming.
Yeah, winter is coming. Oh, boy. You know, you sit there going, you're basically going to perpetuate this grappling for control over something that you may or may not ever get, mm-hmm. but you may end up most likely losing your life over. And now what do you get? Now what have you got?
Mm-hmm.
Now you have nothing
mm-hmm.
other than, I don't know what's in the next world.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very curious about what's there. Mm-hmm. But what about that down through the centuries and these various dynasties? You know, because obviously if they were around for, what you say, an average of 300 years,
mm-hmm.
it means that several generations, the throne was handed down.
Yes.
But
yes.
then there came a point when, okay, we're going to take over and your family's out.
There's an interesting phenomenon of takeovers in the dynastic changes. What I know for sure is they burned down the palace and they rebuilt the palace, and they might also change the capital cities.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you see, the palace right now in Beijing, is the one from the Qing dynasty, but also a little bit remains from the Ming dynasty, so which was the last dynasty, last two dynasty. The one thing, there's some sort of a peaceful takeover where you don't kill the whole royal family.
Mm-hmm.
Usually it's just the emperor that was being asked to step down. Sometimes they could even take over the whole of their family.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like the previous emperor's family would be now my wife's, you know, my sons. But obviously they would also be killing off. There will be, you know, killing off the prince, or
yeah,
you know, it's some sort of negotiation on the top that doesn't really. They wanted to ensure a peaceful takeover,
mm-hmm.
which means no war,
right?
You know,
right.
I mean, the war is to win the war. Once they win the war, it wasn't to kill off the whole population.
It
was to rule the population.
Right.
And so what happened was, like, the Mongols might come in. And they would adopt the Han culture, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So the last the ruling emperors were Manchus, right? And they have their own writing characters, they have their own culture. But once they took over the palace, they learn Mandarin, they mm-hmm. learn Chinese poetry, they learn Chinese paintings. One of the biggest art patrons was Qianlong, emperor, and his collections now is still the most important collection in Taiwan, Taipei Palace Museum. And so it's the fluidity of culture,
mm-hmm.
That when you talk about Chinese empire, mostly you're talking about who is ruling the Han people. Because there are all kinds of different ethnic groups
mm-hmm.
in the border, including the Tibetan region, Tibetan dynasty. We didn't even touch that, you know. They would have a whole different lineage of dynastic change,
right?
Sharing the border with Han Chinese and the Mongolians too. Like the most famous one is Genghis Khan, right?
Right,
and he literally went all the way to Rome. And so
he wanted it all.
Yes. And so when we talk about Chinese history, usually we don't talk about the entirety of these different groups. We usually talk about the Han, who is ruling the Han people.
Mm-hmm.
Capital city change, ruling ethnicity change. And at some point in Tang Dynasty, which is the most artistic, you know, you could say the Renaissance of Chinese art, which is almost 1,000 years ago, the Turks, a lot of the minister are, they would describe them as blue eyes, golden hair,
mm-hmm.
which a lot of them are of Turkic dissent. Mm-hmm. And one of the biggest, like you said, rebellion was led by a Turkish general, because he was so fed up by the emperor, who's just so into this concubine. It's a very famous story. Mm-hmm. You know, he's so into the concubine, and he wasn't ruling the country properly, and there was a huge rebellion.
Mm.
And so the name of the general is An Lushan, and if you Wikipedia him, it could say his descendants are now in Turkey.
You know? Oh, okay.
So because the name, the surname, you can trace down the descendants of the surname. Mm. And so it's a very rich history. I mean, right now we always think of history as just borders.
Yeah.
But it wasn't. It was who does what.
Who does what?
Who does what?
Not where, didn't matter.
Yeah.
And now I'm curious, was Genghis Khan one of the most famous, but were there others who wanted it all and tried over a number of decades to try to do that? Because most of these guys didn't live into their, 50s, 60s? Because either they died in battle, you know, trying to have it all, or died of some disease or some what have you. I don't know what the average lifespan was if you didn't die in battle.
It wasn't long. Only two or three emperors that lived to their 80s. Most of them died in the 60s or 50s.
Right.
But they have hundreds of kids.
Yeah, exactly.
Very they just prolific. Wanted the power to keep within the family.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, it's also very controversy. Your family? You know, your brother's kid is not your kid.
Yeah.
You know, so sometimes when the emperor himself doesn't have sons, if he's nice enough, he would say, okay, my brother's son, I would appoint you as the next ruler. But sometimes you need to kill off each other in order to claim the throne. So
now China is so large, so massive today, that it is, I think, next to impossible to keep out Western influence. And when I say Western, I don't just mean U.S. I mean influence from other parts of the world, literally. Yet it seems that a neighbor and supposedly some kind of an ally, North Korea, has managed to achieve that by completely isolating its entire, probably most of its population, mm-hmm. from the rest of the world, and has inculcated into it. And again, I have to acknowledge that this is the information that I've been given. I don't know that this is all necessarily true.
Mm.
That's another problem with all of this is that unless you can get it from two or three different independent sources, you kind of question whether or not it's true or not. That the people love their ruler. He is God. It has even been said that he does not exhibit some of the same human biological aspects that you and I would.
Mm-hmm.
I won't go into detail. My first question when all of this started to unravel in the summer of 2017. What are these people afraid of? That how is it that they're so afraid that we, the United States, because we seem to be their focal point, how is it that they're so afraid that we're going to come in there and take over? I mean, I don't know that they have any strategic or I don't know that there's an advantage to taking over North Korea, you know. And so on and so forth. I don't know why they're so paranoid, why they've been made so paranoid. I mean, what is it that they're afraid of? I don't want to go live there and take over their country and their government and whatever it is else that they've got going there.
The little I can say, I can say is that that China, North Korea, and Russia used to be a pact.
Okay, all one.
All like their brothers,
right? brothers. Okay, mm-hmm.
And it was just not a very distant memory. It was maybe 50, 60 years ago.
Yeah,
but now they are sort of isolated because China is a capitalist place now.
Which is sort of ironic that it's a communist country with capitalism.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
That's part of its.
I'm just describing.
Yeah, yeah.
Uh-huh. I'm describing the what it's doing. Right,
right. Right.
And I think during the Korean War also, U.S. was involved.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
And so I guess it was just a lot of very recent memories, you know, who helped who 50 years ago and now who is not helping who 50 years later. So I felt like they are sort of deserted by their alliances.
Mm. So China may be there in that respect and, of course, trying to talk to them as the older brother kind of thing to say, hey, would you just calm things down? But they're not really the kind of allies that maybe North Korea is looking for or wants.
Well, I'm just trying to humanize this thing because I couldn't talk about it too smartly politically.
Oh, you and me both.
But
I don't understand it completely myself.
Chinese people, their passport would allow them to go to North Korea anytime.
Yeah.
They can just apply for a visa and they would go for it. They would say summer vacations in North Korea.
Yeah.
That would be their international summer trip.
Yeah.
And so now China is richer and richer. So now their international travels is Europe.
Yeah.
Or U.S.
Or the U.S.,
you know?
Yeah.
But it used to be North Korea. So
wow.
I'm just giving you mm-hmm. an idea.
Yeah.
That now that China is definitely financially more
well off.
Well off.
Yeah, exactly.
And so now even summer trip is no longer in North Korea.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. So
they're feeling left. Maybe they're feeling left out as we speculate. Maybe they're feeling
just
left
speculations.
Out. And they say, look, you're going to let us into the party or we're going to make our way into the party, you know? And you know, as individuals, I know we all have that happen to us.
Mm-hmm.
We do.
Mm-hmm.
Groups, we have that happen to us, depending upon
what group. It's
just
like, who is the Hollywood bad guys now?
Yeah.
You know, it used to be
exactly.
Russian people for a long time.
Yeah.
And then now, they no longer wanted to use Chinese as bad guys because Chinese are pouring money into U.S.
Yeah.
And so Chinese are no longer the bad guys. And who are the bad guys now?
Yeah.
You can see from Hollywood movies.
Yeah, yeah. It's which is actually kind of sad in a way. And I have to say that the only exposure that I ever really had as a kid growing up to any aspect of Chinese culture, of course, was the television series Kung Fu.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how accurate it was. I know it was only one tiny little aspect. And this was taking place during the period of our Western history and so forth. And what I found so fascinating, and I don't know how many people saw it this way, was the fact that he never wanted to fight. That was never, he just wanted to live his life, you
mm-hmm,
know.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, he was escaping because he'd been accused of killing somebody back in China. But nonetheless, he just wanted to live his life. And of course, you know, because he's different, you know. But in this country, we've used and abused just about every nation on the planet's people for our own gain over the centuries, you know, the couple of centuries that we've been here.
Mm-hmm.
And even before that, for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm hoping that maybe we can learn from that. And I know, I don't know if other countries have done the same thing per se, but it seems that we need to adopt some of these other philosophies, you know, of balance, you know, and get back to the business of thriving. Before we wrap up, are you aware in terms of the history we're kind of talking about of China? Has most of the history of China been fairly peaceful, where the people were left alone to do what they wanted to do? They'd farm or they'd, you know, do whatever business they went into and just live their lives and had families and went to vacations in the neighboring village or this kind of thing. Although I think vacations are more of a modern thing. But were there periods when there wasn't all of this turmoil?
I think it has always been turmoil.
Always.
Every 200-300 years.
Yeah.
And Chinese people adjust fairly quickly to the new ruler or the new landlord.
Yeah.
They collect taxes, you know. They work on lands, but there were famines, and and the government would try their best if it's a good emperor, you know, to help and aid. However, but the history of Southeast Asia is so interesting because the borders open and close based on the emperor's likings, right? So I'm sort of the later generations of Chinese that came to Southeast Asia. But in the past, if you are Southern Chinese and you are poor and you are trying to look for opportunities abroad, they would go to Southeast Asia and they would just sail, you know. So there's a Silk Route, they would call the Water Silk Route, which is what Chinese is embracing right now, the Silk Route. Like, try to revive the idea of the Silk Route, where you travel across different countries to embrace different cultures, and you work together, you collaborate, and to gain knowledge, to help each other grow. And so that's sort of like the slogan right now. It's called, you know, reviving the Silk Route. And so what I'm trying to say is that people are never stuck in one place.
Right.
People are always mobile. My dad's dialect group is called the Hakka people. They basically were northerners, and then slowly they worked their way south over the span of a few hundred years. And now most of the Hakka people are in the south, and they travel because of war, of poverty, and they settled in the place in southern China, and they even have unique architectures that represents their people. And so, yeah, I don't think any country has a history where people just live there for hundreds of years without experiencing any sort of change.
Yeah,
I think it's a story of survival. You know, there are tons of Chinese Americans, Asian Americans that still have very fresh memory of China, like me. Mine is maybe two generation distance, and I bet I met Chinese who are five generation, and their parents were here in the 1800s. Not parents, their ancestors. And I met a Chinese American who live in Fresno, and they still have memories of Chinatown being burned down in recent memories. I think it was Santa Barbara used to have a Chinatown. And so I think it was also burned down during the same period of time.
Oh, wow.
Where there was an aggression towards Chinese people. And when Chinese first moved to United States, they were not allowed to marry. They were not allowed to marry outside of their race. And there were no women. There were no Chinese women, because most of these were male workers. Yeah. So you know, it's still very recent that that you know, there's all kinds of policies that discriminate and disadvantaged, you know. And so you would argue, oh, at least it's not slavery. Chinese didn't go through slavery, but we also went through a lot of discrimination when we were looking for jobs or migration and or even settle down. There's all kinds of challenges within US. So yeah, I mean, Americans don't need to look that far into world history to see our world history actually do collide here in the US.
and that's something that, of course, the reason that I wanted to have you on the program to talk a little bit about this was so that we could understand better and wrap our minds around it a little bit anyway, and that is that we are all connected, and that our actions affect other people. You know, that's just that's the reality of things, and that that what went on 5,000 years ago, 3,000 years ago, or 300 or 3 days ago has an impact, has had an impact, and continues to do so, unless we make new choices and say, you know what, I'm not going to repeat the actions of my father or grandfather or great-grandfather you know, in terms of holding on to this anger and bitterness. And certainly they have every right to, But at the same time, it's like, okay, when are we going to move beyond that and find that place of balance that we talked about earlier in the program? And then start to build communities where, yes, change, that's a given. Change is always going to happen. I mean, especially if you start talking about natural disasters. But we don't have to go to war. We don't have to go get into conflicts with one another if we would just stop and say, okay, wait a minute, where are you coming from? I see that you're upset. I need to understand where you're coming from. And hopefully that person is willing to share where they're coming from. And now I have a better understanding of why you feel the way that you do. Now let me share with you, if you don't mind, where I'm coming from. And now you hopefully will understand where I'm coming from and why I'm, you know, positioning myself to, you know, do whatever. And we can put down the shields and the weapons and the walls and start working together to build something greater than, because my observations, and I've only been around a scant 57 years on this planet. And based upon the history that I've seen, what little of the history that I've seen both in the, of the U.S. as well as globally, is we have not moved forward. If anything, we've actually gone backward. And it's time to stop that backward motion and start moving forward again to thrive and not just survive.
For me, one thing that I really managed to live through this times of change is that you scale down the issue to yourself, to the people around you, and you observe how you behave with other people. And for example, you talk about tension between different cultural groups or different communities or racial tension that is happening in US, but I have it at my own house, you know.
Yeah.
Husband and wife conflict. Why do we bicker?
Yeah.
And where are you coming from? Where am I coming from? My husband's Kenyan and I'm Chinese. And I translate Chinese to English as we speak. And therefore, I have all kinds of grammatical errors sometimes.
Right.
As I argue. And so there would be a pattern of quarreling where you just want to poke at the grammar mistakes, or you poke at the issue that is not really the issue.
Right.
Or do you want to poke at the real thing?
Yeah.
And it was nice that there's all this conflict resolution thing that I watch on TV that is almost humorous, right? So one of the thing is that, okay, wife lash out, and then husband said, I hear that you are angry. And just being acknowledged helps calm things down.
I may not know why you are angry, but I hear that you're angry.
Yes, and even that is changed the whole situation.
Yeah.
And so now I can say that if there's any conflict, I said, I hear you're angry. So, but how can we talk about this peacefully without bickering, without shouting at each other, without humiliating each other? And you know, we have all kinds of pride. I felt my ego sometimes is attacked by my own husband. And he is the closest thing I have.
Yeah.
And even that, I felt like I was attacked. So with strangers, I just imagine it would be exponential. Right? And so ego is such a big thing. And
And I think that the one thing that can kind of help is the fact that, okay, wait a minute. He is here and he's trying to communicate with me, you know, because I go through this with my wife as well, although we don't have those kind, you know, a lot of real disagreements. We're, you know, fairly in sync, but still every once in a while, you know, it doesn't take much for me to say the wrong words or phrases.
Exactly.
And because I'm not understanding. I mean, it's not that I don't understand the words that she's saying, but it's that she's using different words to describe something that is saying something different to me.
Yes.
So now I've got to, I've got to stop.
Yes.
And try to decipher or get clarity from her.
Yes.
before going further without going off the handle and sounding angry and frustrated, you know, and then that upsets her even more. And then we start tail spinning. So,
yeah, like even a father talking to a child, the child is not happy.
Mm-hmm.
And then the father said, okay, is it because of lunchtime? Somebody took your lunchbox away.
Yeah.
Is it your teacher telling you something? Because we automatically assume that a child cannot communicate clearly, and therefore the parent would have to do a lot of guessing.
Yeah.
But then we don't do that for adults. We don't apply the same consideration or the same sensibility towards an adult conversation. But sometimes we do have a child in us. We do just want to be like...
Sometimes
we don't want to say what it is. We want you to guess.
I was watching a scene from, I was watching a news piece where they were showing this individual who was involved in this natural disaster, this Hurricane Harvey. And they showed this Red Cross worker. Walking up to this this elderly woman who had just been through, obviously, been rescued. She'd been up to her. Actually, I remember hearing that her home had flooded and she was actually, the water was 4 feet over her head. I mean, that's how high the water was. And she managed to get upstairs and da-da-da. And she didn't say a word to the woman. The Red Cross worker just reached out and took her and held her.
Mm.
And it's like, and that's all that she needed at that moment. That's
mm-hmm.
all she needed. And that's mm-hmm. all we ever, sometimes that's all we ever want is that level of acknowledgement. And that's really what we're trying to get through to the folks on this program is
mm-hmm.
we've got to work on better communicating one with another. And we'll go a heck of a lot further and we can start thriving instead of just surviving.
Mm-hmm.
It'll make a big difference in the world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
CJ Liu, I want to thank you so much for joining us on the program and for sharing your time and your story, as well as a little bit of the history of China and helping us to better understand that part of the world and how it has affected us,
mm-hmm.
and the fact that, you know, we're all living here together.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my belief, because if the Creator had intended for each one of us to live solitary lives, I'm pretty sure there are enough planets for each one of us to inhabit one by ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
The reality is, guess what? Nearly 8 billion people mm-hmm. are all here on this planet.
Mm-hmm.
That says to me that we're supposed to try to work together.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm hoping maybe, I don't know, somebody out there can get through to some of these rulers at the top of the pile and say, could you come down for just a minute and try to understand that you're scaring the hell out of us,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it's your own people that you're scaring, not just them over there or them over there. You're scaring us.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Yes, we have respect for you. We love you. We worship you, whatever. Could you just tone it down a little bit and let's find out what's going on here?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that can be in business. That can be in your family.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Could we just tone it down a little bit and find out what's going on? Or, you know, I see that you're angry. I hear that you're angry.
I hear
that you're afraid. You know, and of course for guys, it's, well, can I fix it? Don't even try. Just listen. And I thank you so much. I've been listening to you for the last hour and a half, and it's just been fantastic. And thank
you
for joining us.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you so much, Richard.
Your website, so that people can get in touch with you, find out more about your Chinese calligraphy. It's fascinating, this catalog that you've got here of the different things. Actually, I opened it up to what I thought was the front. And am I correct? It goes from back to front in the U.S. as far as we're concerned.
Uh-huh.
It starts from the right
to left
and goes to left, because I went to the left to start and I started, oh, there's her bio. Why is it in the front? And of course it's also Chinese.
Yes.
As
I'm,
well,
I'm playing with that.
I like that.
In this,
I like
catalog.
That. What's your website?
It's cjliu.com, SIJIE loo.com.
And we'll be linked to your website as well, yes, on our website as well. So thank you again. And before I let you go, I have three final questions for you,
sure,
that I ask all my guests. And you may have answered it in some form throughout this interview, but I'm going to ask it anyway, and you can answer it directly. First of all, who is CJ Liu?
Oh, my goodness. CJ Liu is a daughter, a sister, a wife, a female artist, a thinker, a citizen of the world, is trying to pursue a creative life to balance her interactions with the world.
Mm. What is it that you hope to or want to achieve with the work you're doing now?
The short answer would be to figure life itself out by pursuing art, to figure life itself out.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
My mortality, just to understand myself better and to understand the world better.
Mm. And finally, what is your life's purpose?
Life purpose. To learn to give, to learn to love, and to learn to accept.
CJ Liu, again, thank you so much for joining us, local Chinese calligraphy artist here in Santa Barbara, California. It's been a great pleasure. I hope we can have you back again, because obviously we've just literally scratched the surface of this whole subject. And, you know, it just intrigues me to no end. I mean, you've got a nation, a country that, again, spans so many thousands of years. And so many people have come from that country to other parts of the world, including the United States, including yourself, who have had an influence and an impact. And I'm hoping that maybe through subsequent programs and interviews, we can talk about some of these other people who have changed the lives of the rest of us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, through whatever work it is that they're doing. It's not just all about technology, folks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are other ways that folks have influenced and impacted our lives and our cultures and so forth. And maybe we'll get more into that as well in terms of talking about in more in depth about your culture and how you keep it alive in this day and age.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you so much.
Yeah.
We will definitely have you back. Thank you again.
Thank you so much.
I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love Talal.